Last time on Big Savage, three of Megan's friends testify to her character and also divulge their own perceptions of the relationship between Megan and Alex. All three attest to witnessing a cross carved into Megan's back during her stay in the hospital, but none provide hard physical evidence for the jury. After speaking with one of those friends, ex-boyfriend and criminal justice major Doug Widows, Megan contacts police for a third interview, saying that the two had not slipped as she initially claimed, but that Alex had essentially forced her off the ledge at High Rock, that he had instructed her to hold the knife out for him, and when she tried to pull away, he had grabbed the knife over her hand and cut his own throat with the blade. On this episode, Alex's therapist takes the stand with some unusual things to share, and evidence that police allege to have seen is nowhere to be found. We also hear testimony from a stranger who encountered Alex 1 week before High Rock. Her story only deepens the mystery. This is going to be a very personal episode in several ways, and as we were preparing to release it, Sarah and I decided that it would be a good idea to preface it with a brief conversation about our feelings and intentions surrounding Episode 5, but also the show in general. That's coming up first. From Chromatic Media in the heart of Morgantown, West Virginia, this is Big Savage. Okay, well, I'll start then. So what initiated this conversation for me was when the trial was over and I went to speak to Alex's family, when I approached them, I've never experienced this like trepidation in interviews or reporting in the way I have in that moment. And in the process of sort of exploring why that is, why I feel that way, there's a part of me that realizes that in this episode especially, we're going to be getting into some really personal family dirty laundry type stuff that just came out as a matter of course in the trial, and some painful personal stuff like Jay Stevens' stage 4 lung cancer and the strain that that additionally put this family under before Alex's death. And that makes me really uncomfortable to put out there the stuff that we're going to talk about today. I sort of identify with Alex in some ways, having this plan for my life that fell through early and then feeling sort of lost, not knowing what to do, looking through these alternative philosophies and like experimenting with drugs, all sorts of psychedelics, that sort of thing. That was all just part of my life course. And I guess the last thing I want to do is hurt Alex's family by talking about this stuff that I personally went through.
I guarantee you there is so much going on that we don't know about that doesn't even really have anything to do with the case that has come out, and people asking awkward questions and saying things about Alex, and it's getting around. And it's not only happening to the dad and the mom, but it's also happening to the sister. And this is just the icing on the cake. And I do feel bad about that. On the other hand, we're not getting in their face and saying, well, what about this and what about this? We gave them a chance to talk to us, and I think we were pretty respectful about it. I did write a letter. I pretty much poured my heart out in it saying, hey, we want to tell your story. We want you to have a chance to speak your truth. And they chose not to, ultimately.
Yeah, and that's perfectly understandable. And no one would fault them for that, because having to go through this is just unimaginable. But we did want to let people know that we're not callous to this. This isn't some project in which we push aside the reality of what we're dealing with or the seriousness of what we're dealing with in the search for, you know, media sensation or whatever.
Right. These are real people, whether you're Team Alex or Team Megan. Doesn't matter. I mean, this isn't fiction. This is real.
People who have strong feelings about this case should remember before talking with each other and like posting comments about the case online that like demonizing people is easy, and taking these stories like these ones you're about to hear in this episode and trying to like construe an entire family relationship out of these singular examples, it's not healthy and it's not what we want to do. We're just portraying the trial as best we can. Sarah, did you want to talk a little about, you mentioned sort of off the cuff, I think later in the episode, that you really empathize with Tristan, Alex's sister. Do you not want to go into that personal stuff? Or?
Yeah, I will. I had a brother who was 6 years younger than me. He had a brand new Mustang. He was trying to show off for a friend. He peeled out of the driveway and sort of lost control on some loose gravel. He flipped the car over a gravel pile and bounced it pretty hard. And he injured himself really, really badly. he was in an induced coma. He had brain swelling. He had a shunt. He had a tube sticking out of his skull. And we were just, you know, crossing our fingers and hoping he was going to be okay. He didn't make it. And that was in 2009. Flash forward to 2012. My father is diagnosed with a glioblastoma. That's a really aggressive, malignant form of brain cancer. And as I was listening to Tristan talk on the stand, I remembered just how angry I was at my brother for not being there during all of that. Like, you're not supposed to be alone when you do that. And I remember my dad telling my mom that he wanted me to take care of the funeral arrangements because I did such a good job with my brother. And he meant that as a compliment, for sure. But when you're expecting your sibling to be there with you, it can breed some animosity, and you get mad at yourself for being mad at them, but the truth is, it's just fear. Just being afraid of going it alone and being really upset that you have to do it alone. And a lot of that came up while I was in the trial, and I remembered exactly how that felt. And I definitely don't mean to add to that at all. But it's a story that is out in the open whether we want it to be or not.
Last episode, you heard reenactments of Megan's interviews with police in the hospital during the 48 hours following her trip to High Rock with Alex. The voice actor who played Megan, Gina Cubitt, did an amazing job, especially since she had never heard Megan's voice. But there is one fundamental quality of those interview sessions that inherently can't be captured by a reenactment.
Well, and it was hard to just decipher what she was saying on those recordings, because she starts out very matter of fact in describing something and then just on a dime goes into this squealing, her crying thing, where even you've got the police in the recording saying, wait a minute, what? You just couldn't understand what she was saying.
Even in the transcript, it said indecipherable.
Right.
Where she's crying and squealing so hard is when it says indecipherable, because you can't tell what she's saying.
You can't tell what she's saying in so many parts, but every now and then she's crystal clear. Like she says, I laid there for hours.
Sarah, Teresa, and our court reporter Jordan unanimously described this aspect of Megan's voice as a high-pitched squeal. Obviously, those parts of the police transcript that read indecipherable could not be duplicated in a reenactment. A final note on Megan's statements. In one of the interviews, she makes a pretty strange claim about the fall itself.
Well, she also mentions in falling, she knew approximately how long she had been falling from the cliff because she was counting as she went down.
I just jumped down a hole in Jamaica that is 25 feet, and I guarantee you that I didn't have the presence of mind to count. I was like, oh shit, I'm falling. And I did it on purpose.
And you did it in daylight.
I did it in daylight. There were witnesses, and I knew I was going to hit the water, not the ground. And it still scared the shit out of me. And it's hard for me to imagine being like, oh, we're falling now. I better count.
And needless to say, nothing about the knife makes sense.
Including why it's left at the scene. That's one of my biggest questions. Why did she leave the knife at the scene?
If you're gonna jump off a cliff, why jump with a knife? That's just, do you wanna land on that? Hand it to her so she can land on that? These things don't add up.
Hi.
Reporting on cases like this usually involves submitting public records requests to see evidence firsthand. When we submitted a broad request for all of the evidence in this case, the total cost for documents, photographs, and videos came out to over $2,000. So we decided to pare down the request, make it more specific, thus reduce the quantity and the cost of the information. There were four things that we were most interested in. The first was any image that showed the cross supposedly cut into Megan's back. Maryland State Police told us that the state's evidence does not contain any of these images, which we expected to be the case. Megan was taken straight from the Broadwater House to the hospital, and her medical records are sealed. The second item on our revised list was any video from either Alex or Megan's cell phones that contained any conversation between them. This request also came up empty. The final two items center around evidence mentioned by police in Megan's third interview. One was the video we talked about last episode, which showed Alex and Megan burning things at High Rock the day before Alex died. In the transcript, Detective Schramm claims the video was found on Alex's cell phone, and Detective Martin says he is also aware of the video. But since our last episode was released, Maryland State Police have told us that, inexplicably, this video does not exist in the evidence file. Near the end of Megan's third interview, investigators also mention a symbol spray-painted on a stone at High Rock. Detective Martin describes it as similar to a circled asterisk or a pentagram, like, quote, a circle with a star through it. They ask Megan if Alex had named that symbol or whether she knew what it represented. She says no, that she'd just seen him draw it on a piece of paper once and then spray paint it at High Rock. But then Detective Martin asks a startling question. When did he carve it into his hands and feet? This is potentially important because it's the first point on the timeline we have anyone claiming that Alex had cut into flesh with a blade. Megan replies, quote, I didn't realize he had carved it into his hands and feet. So our revised public records request specifically asked for photos of this symbol spray painted on the rocks and any autopsy photos that showed these carvings on his hands and feet. But again, since our last episode was released, Maryland State Police have told us that there are no photos showing these carvings and no such images were shown during the trial.
And that would have been like the least gory of the photos, and they never showed the pictures of this asterisk on the rocks or of him carving it into himself at all.
Right.
There was just mention of it. So I don't know if that was one of those false things where they just throw something out and see if she'll go with it or not. I really didn't know what to think about that.
From Tully's perspective as Megan's lawyer, why not bring up this part of the transcript in court? If the photos of Alex's body did not conclusively show whether his hands and feet had been carved, why not impress upon the jury that the state itself claimed Alex had been carving into flesh? Or, if the detectives made up the story, why not put them on the stand to explain to the jury that they tried to feed Megan false information that would have helped her case and that she didn't go for it? Again, all of this is confusing.
Yeah, I mean, that was a great segue into, well, this makes sense. This is his mentality. He's carving into flesh now, and he never took the bait for that.
Right.
Of the four high-priority items on our public records request, two of which the detectives specifically mention, all came up empty. Witness, Dr. Patricia Robison.
She worked for Frostburg State as a clinical psychologist, but she was also involved in the coexist group that Alex was in. She was the advisor.
She had spent significant time with Alex. She'd gotten to know him, and here we were getting to hear this inside psychological information that normally we don't get any kind of taste of that because of HIPAA laws.
And he had access to her. He had her cell phone number. He would email her. They seemed to have a really close personal relationship. And she diagnosed him as having a depressive disorder. She said it was an adjustment disorder, which is when someone has a sort of over-the-top reaction to stressors in their life. And he was having trouble dealing. And so she would check in with him. They met once a week for his counseling. But then on the side, he was the VP of the Coexist group, and so he met her as an advisor for that too. And they had plans to meet again in January, but that didn't work out.
Dr. Robison's profile on the Frostburg State University website reads in part, quote, "Her orientation includes interpersonal, humanistic, existential, Jungian, and transpersonal psychological theories. She is also a certified graduate of the Barbara Brennan School of Healing Science. This training, alongside insights derived from a desert vision quest, permits her to incorporate the transpersonal mysteries of soul and spirit into her work with others. She has experienced and witnessed non-ordinary states of consciousness, including spiritual awakenings and existential crises, and is adept at exploring and understanding such experiences without discounting or pathologizing them. Dr. Robison embraces the new movement of interspirituality that includes esoteric contemplative traditions across all world religions, East and West," unquote. Alex started meeting with Robison in September of 2015. By February of 2016, 5 months later, she had categorized his condition as in remission, and on the stand, she said he was no longer suicidal and even seemed somewhat optimistic about life. It's around this time that Alex posts online that he has, quote, "truly met himself" in Porter Cemetery.
She said that he no longer had plans or intent, which sounds to me like at one point there was.
Yeah, she says he was no longer as depressed. I've got her quoted as saying that. He wanted to finish his degree, write music. She said at that point he was free of suicidal risk, which Tully had definitely painted a picture in his opening statements that Alex was suicidal.
And I felt like she was agreeing with that. At this point, and this isn't even Tully talking to her. This is Lisa Welch asking her questions, and she's talking about the suicide. And she agreed that, yeah, this boy was in serious turmoil emotionally.
His parents locked him out of their house because they were afraid of him.
This lockout occurred after Alex threatened to harm himself with a kitchen knife.
My notes say that he threatened to hurt himself to demonstrate how much pain he was in. And I think this was regarding his father. There was mention of him hiding a shotgun from his dad. And there's a little bit of confusion, at least for me, whether or not he was afraid that his dad would commit suicide with the shotgun, or if he was afraid of actually being shot himself. There's also a mention of Alex hallucinating on cough syrup and thinking his friend was the devil.
That's around the time that she said Alex had problems with his family and his parents had locked him out of their house because they were afraid of him.
Right. I have notes here that they were afraid of him after the knife incident because he'd smashed pictures of his dad and his mom. And Tully said that he had a hatred of his family, but she didn't say that. But she did say that his dad had asked Alex not to break in while he was at the doctor's office in an email.
Which Alex had already done once before.
And said that Alex's mother had taken pictures of the damage. Tristan had been told to call the police or the hospital if Alex was suspected to be violent.
At one point, Stephen said he wanted a restraining order against his father because the elder Stevens had threatened physical abuse against his son, but later changed his mind.
Though Robison listed Alex's condition as in remission by February of 2016, it was 9 months later, around Thanksgiving, that family strife went from bad to worse.
I think this is when Jay was going through the health crisis and he'd been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And Alex was having a lot of trouble with that.
says that he damaged a wall in his apartment and he threw a guitar through the TV.
This is around the time, too, where Tully's pointing out that Alex had a serious drinking problem.
Now, as I understand, when he was kicked out of the Coast Guard, he was put into a rehabilitation for his drinking because he'd been drinking and blacking out.
Here's his DWI charge. The plea date is June of 2016.
And one of the symptoms for an adjustment disorder is really reckless behavior. So it would make sense that the DWI, maybe in her eyes, was an attempted suicide on some level. And he was no longer reckless with himself and his own personal safety.
Right.
These episodes of increasing intensity took place around Thanksgiving. According to Megan, 1 month later, she, Alex, and Alex's whole family attended a Christmas Eve church service together. 10 days after that, Alex was found dead in Savage River. Over the last year of Alex's meetings with Robison, the mystical ideas and beliefs the two shared started to come up in their sessions together.
Alex had mentioned in an email that he had astrally projected and seen her sleeping at night and asked her if she had any, like, feelings for that, like if she knew that. And there was a mention that Alex had told everyone he was a messiah and needed to collect apostles. This is what he told his family. And that was one of the reasons they were concerned about him.
Tully read from mental health and police reports. He said, showed Stevens was interested in a suicide attempt from the late author Philip K. Dick.
Philip K. Dick had attempted suicide 20 years before he was born on his birthday. And he thought that was very relevant. He thought that perhaps he was a reincarnation of Philip K. Dick. And he seemed almost obsessed with the man's work. And he had searched Most Beautiful Suicide.
Most Beautiful Suicide is the unofficial title of a famous 1947 photograph depicting a deceased young woman named Evelyn McHale. The issue of Life magazine in which the photo first appeared captioned it with this, quote, "On May Day, just after leaving her fiancé, 23-year-old Evelyn McHale wrote a note. He is much better off without me. I wouldn't make a good wife for anybody," she wrote. Then she crossed it out. She went to the observation platform of the Empire State Building. Through the mist, she gazed at the street, 86 floors below. Then she jumped. In her desperate determination, she leaped clear of the setbacks and hit a United Nations limousine parked at the curb. Across the street, photography student Robert Wiles heard an explosive crash. Just 4 minutes after Evelyn McHale's death, Wiles got this picture of death's violence and its composure, unquote. The photograph is known for the tension between its visceral, morbid subject matter and the beauty of its composition, the peaceful repose of Evelyn's body amidst the crumpled roof of the limousine without a trace of blood. It almost looks staged. Both Sarah and I had seen it before.
Tully also said Stevens had been reading about quantum suicide.
To understand what quantum suicide is, we have to talk just a bit about quantum physics in general, but if you'll allow us a 5-minute detour, we hope to show you that this tangent is relevant to understanding quantum suicide in general, but also possibly Alex's state of mind at High Rock. First, you have to understand that before quantum mechanics, most scientists just thought of the world as this giant clock that ran purely on cause and effect. The laws of physics determined everything. Newton basically believed that if you could somehow know everything about the universe right now, you could theoretically determine exactly what it was going to be like in 5 minutes or 5 years, because it all runs according to definite, predetermined laws.
Quantum mechanics came along in the early part of the 20th century and said, actually, that idea is only approximate. That idea is not fully correct.
This is Brian Greene. He's probably the nation's best-known theoretical physicist. He has a best-selling book called The Elegant Universe about superstrings and hidden dimensions. This audio is from an appearance on Fresh Air in 2011.
The best you can do according to quantum mechanics is predict the likelihood, the probability of one outcome or another.
Quantum particles can, and in fact are, in multiple positions or states simultaneously until they are either interacted with or observed.
This is one of my best friends, Kalen Fisher. He is the person who read Alex's Reddit post for us in episode 2. Kalen grew up in Cumberland, just across the river from Megan's family, and lived in the area for a long time afterward, and I visited there often over the years. Much of what drew Kalen and I together was our interest in many of the same philosophical and scientific interests held by Alex. For people like us who had given up faith in traditional religious explanations about the universe, the mysteries surrounding quantum physics reintroduced the supernatural into our lives.
All right, but without contradicting the scientific side of it, yeah, I think that's a lot of the appeal for me as well.
A significant problem in quantum theory is describing how this fuzzy probability wave function collapses to one actual reality. Like, how does the universe just decide to go from multiple probabilities existing at the same time to a single definite property that can be observed by humans?
A fellow named Hugh Everett suggested a radical way to deal with this problem. He said, the idea that only one outcome happens in a given experiment, that's just not right. He said, follow the math of quantum mechanics. Take it very seriously, and it is telling us that there are two possible outcomes. The particle can be here or there. Therefore, what happens is there are two universes.
So practically, this means that at every decision point we face, the universe literally splits off into different universes.
Each choice happens, just not in the same universe, so to speak, I guess. So, like, you know, if I make a decision, then somewhere there exists a universe where I made the other decision, and that continues indefinitely until you have, you know, an incomprehensible number of alternate universes, basically.
Back then, everyone thought it was crazy. Now, not so much.
What we're learning from quantum physics, if you take the math seriously, is that every possible reality consistent with the laws actually happens in its own separate universe.
While Everett's multiverse theory has slowly gained traction in the scientific community, some of his beliefs have not, and here we draw closer to Alex's story. Everett believed that his many-worlds theory guaranteed him what he called quantum immortality. He argued that at each branch of possible action, human consciousness is bound to follow whatever path does not lead to death. So the theory says that if you try to commit suicide, even if the rest of the world sees you die in this universe, you always experience survival in another timeline. Quantum suicide.
I mean, that mode of thinking allows you to be reckless because there's no consequence. I mean, we really don't know what his belief system was, like what he was just kind of interested in, what piqued his curiosity, and what he actually felt, no, this is what I am going to follow. But if he really truly believed in quantum suicide, the suicide wouldn't hold the same weight as it would someone who doesn't believe.
That's true.
So for him, maybe killing yourself is just the next step. For me, that's the end of the road.
This all may sound like fringe philosophy to you, but I was shocked to see it pop up for the first time in mainstream culture recently. A week before the 2-year anniversary of Alex's death, Netflix aired its Black Mirror spinoff, Bandersnatch, which is the first choose-your-own-adventure movie that I've ever seen. In one story timeline, two video game designers drop acid in an 8th-floor London flat. I should note here that on the wall is a poster praising Philip K. Dick, the author who Alex was a big fan of. As the acid kicks in, one of the two characters begins explaining some of his philosophies in a fast-paced rant.
People think there's one reality, but there's loads of them all snaking off like roots, and what we do on one path affects what happens on other paths. Time is a construct. People think you can't go back and change things, but you can. That's what flashbacks are.
And in the midst of all this, he takes his friend out onto the apartment balcony.
We're on one path. Right now, me and you. And how one path ends is immaterial. It's how our decisions along that path affect the whole that matters. Do you believe me?
I don't know.
I'll prove it. One of us is going over. Over there.
Here, he points over the balcony railing to the ground below.
You die.
It wouldn't matter, because there are other timelines, Stefan.
The parallels to Alex's story are striking, and it was shocking to see what I thought were obscure concepts represented in mainstream media so soon after his death. But perhaps you're wondering whether anyone would actually believe this stuff. To which we add our final note to this story. Hugh Everett, the physicist who developed the concepts of the multiverse and quantum immortality, died of a heart attack in his bed. Years later, his daughter Liz killed herself. In her suicide note, she said she would be going to a parallel universe to be with her father. Witness, Diane Kenner.
Oh yeah, Diane was sworn in and the judge forgot to bring the jury back. I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, is a secret from them? So Diane Kenner basically told the jury that a young man had shown up on her door and he didn't have any shoes. It was like 11 p.m. the day after Christmas, and he was lost and he couldn't find his car. And when she asked him what he was doing out in the woods, he said he was out there to just kind of clear his head, and he had lost his eyeglasses and his shoes and he couldn't find where he left his car. And she said that she was kind of checking him out to see if he looked high, like she was checking out his pupils. And when he realized that that's what she was doing, he became angry.
She also said that Stevens told her because his father was battling cancer, he'd been in the woods to clear his head.
And he threw his wallet and his keys inside her house. Like, they're standing in a doorway, and he's just tossing his things inside her home so that she can see what his name is and just, like, hey, trust me, I'm not here to murder you. But she said he'd been, like, screaming. Like, he was not okay.
Diane had her grandson help Alex find his car, which ended up being just down the road, not far at all. We should mention that this witness was called by Lisa Thayer Welch. You may be asking yourself, as we did, why the prosecution would want testimony about Alex approaching a stranger in such a frantic state of mind, only days before High Rock.
2 days later, she and her grandson received a package containing a glass bird feeder and a thank you note for their help from Stevens, from Alexander Stevens.
Yeah, I guess this was to show that Alex was considerate for leaving a thank you note for someone and all that. But all I took away from that was he was acting irrational, and I would have been afraid. I would not have let him inside my house. And I mean, you can buy me a bird feeder later, but that's not gonna really pay for the fear of having someone who's unstable and on my couch. If his car was really that close and he was that lost, then surely he was on something.
And why was he barefoot?
Yeah, and no one ever said whether, like, he found the glasses again, like, if they were in the car or
with his shoes.
Yeah, but, like, what do you do? Just, like, does he just normally get naked in the woods? Is this the part, like, where High Rock kicks in and we've got both of these people who are naked? Like, is that what happened? He just couldn't find all of his stuff? I mean, it made more questions for me rather than, oh, this is a nice, considerate young man because we helped him out and he left us a gift.
Yeah, you know, we've definitely heard Alex described as someone who had some behavioral and mental health problems. We've also heard plenty of people describe him as just being kind, considerate, having his act together, having plans for the future, being a good kid, student.
Well, and he put the grandson's name on the package because that was the only one that he remembered. And he made sure he did it when they weren't there. It was almost like he was too embarrassed to deliver it and be like, hey, thank you. But he left it on the porch so that they would find it. And this would have been just like, what, a week before they went over the cliff? It kind of reads to me like that was one of the things he wanted to make amends for, is I really screwed up. I embarrassed myself in front of this family. One of the first things you do when you're going to commit suicide is you try to right some wrongs and give away possessions, things like that. So I could see him trying to make an apology there.
Yet at the same time, though, his autopsy is roughly less than a week later, and he's got no chemical substances in his system.
Yeah. He doesn't, but if he was using hallucinogenics or even cough syrup like he had before, it wouldn't show up. And it certainly wouldn't show up if he'd been drunk that night.
It all just makes you ask more questions.
Right. No, it paints a picture of someone who's very emotionally unstable. Regardless of whether he's using drugs or not, his behavior is not someone who's in control.
On the next episode of Big Savage, Jay and Tristan, Alex's father and sister, take the stand, and Chromatic Media wins the lawsuit over Megan's 911 call.
Alex Stevens, and where is Alex?
He's still in the woods.
Okay, was he okay?
No.
Is he hurt, or is he...
I believe he's dead.
Big Savage is a Chromatic Media project. It was produced by myself and Sarah James McLaughlin, with lots of assistance from our co-host, Teresa McMinn, and courtroom reporting by Jordan Carter. For updates and discussions surrounding the case, you can follow the Big Savage Facebook page. You can also follow Chromatic Media on Facebook, Instagram, and on the web at chromatic.media. That's K-R-O-M-A-T-I-C.media. If you find yourself liking this story, take a moment to rate it on your podcasting service. It makes a difference in helping others to find good stuff. You can also check out our other Appalachian true crime podcast, Merritt and Karen, the WVU Coed Murders, which currently maintains a 5-star status on iTunes. The music for this show was written and recorded in Morgantown, West Virginia, by John Smithers, Nick Larson, Annie Stroud, and Nathan Snyder. Stay tuned.